The Independent Policy Forum is a series of seminars and debates and lectures that the Institute is sponsoring. We're holding them about two or three times per month, involving many top scholars and policy analysts and authors of books that we think are important. And we think the authors tonight and their book are very important. As many of you know, the Independent Institute is an academic research institute. In addition to producing our own books, we have about 130 research fellows right now. We also have a quarterly journal called the Independent Review, which, if you don't subscribe, you know, you're just not enjoying life. The Institute was started about 12 years ago and is intended to pursue non-politicized scholarship in public policy. So you'll find the topics that we address will be almost any public policy issue and almost any aspect of government. As in all fields of science, in the history of economic thought, there have been numerous economists who have made major contributions to the growth of economic analysis and its greater sophistication. Occasionally, however, there have been economists who have made profound insights into economics and extended its analysis in ways that others didn't either think of or think was possible. Such is the case with the work of Gary Becker. Gary's work is probably best known for the concept of human capital. Some of you may have read his book, Human Capital. But he's developed and applied that concept and related concepts to issues far beyond the traditional realm of economics, sometimes surprising and upsetting some people. But it's certainly been, I think, a development that has advanced knowledge in ways that we all can benefit from. He's pioneered work in such areas as crime, population, the family, labor issues, racial and gender discrimination, immigration, and many other areas. Gary has effectively shown that economics is the study of human behavior and has cut through the mush that you'd so much find in many other disciplines and in much of public policy discussion. I first met Gary while I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. Although I had read his book on the family, which is called The Treatise on the Family, and also Human Capital, what always amazed me about him was not only a dedication to scholarly excellence, but a creative intellect that would always challenge those around him. But I think I'm most especially grateful to two other people for actually the work that Gary's produced. The first is Milton Friedman, who in 1951, while Gary was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, was teaching a course in microeconomics, and Gary claims that that encounter inspired him with the excitement of economics. Before, he had taken economics but didn't see its unique insight. Gary has also worked with many top scholars, ranging from George Stigler, Theodore Schultz, both of which were Nobel laureates as well, Aaron Director, James Holt Coleman, just to name a few. But I also want to thank another person who was, I think, influential in the work that Gary is doing, and that's our second speaker tonight, Gideon Neshat. And the reason is not just because she is his partner, but because she is responsible, really, for the book we have tonight. If it wasn't for her, Gary probably would not have done the column in Business Week, and he admits that it was her persuasive influence that got him to do it, and we're the benefactors of that. As a result of the enormous depth and range of Gary's work, it's touched people and institutions that we wouldn't have predicted. Gary and I were both at a private conference at the Vatican a couple years ago, and Gary was, aside from the Pope, Gary was clearly the star. I mean, there was no question about
I'll
it. Gary.
That secondary position.
And I think the influence that he brought to meetings of that type show the range of importance and influence that his work has generated. The book, The Economics of Life, assembles essays by Gary and Gidi, largely from his Business Week column on a host of economic and social issues. As with Milton Friedman's popular books, The Economics of Life is, I believe, a gateway book for others to enter the world of economics and discover its power and excitement. Gary actually received the Nobel Prize for Economic Science in 1992. He is currently the Rose Marie and Jack R. Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is University Professor of Economics and Sociology at the University of Chicago and Associate at the Economics Research Center at the National Opinion Research Center. In addition to his monthly column for Business Week, he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, past president of the American Economic Association, for which he received the prestigious Seidman Award, and he's been a fellow for the National Bureau of Economic Research. I mentioned a couple of his other books. His most recent book, in addition to this one, is a book called Accounting for Tastes, published by Harvard, as are most of his books currently. Other books include Essence of Becker, The Economic Approach to Human Behavior, and The Economics of Discrimination, in addition to the ones I've already mentioned. Our second speaker, Gideon Neshat Becker, is a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution and an associate professor of history at the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois in Chicago. A member of the editorial board for World Civilization, she's a member of the Middle East Studies Committee at the University of Illinois and a member of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Chicago. Her other books include The Origins of Modern Reform in Iran, 1870 to 1880, Middle Eastern History, and Women and Revolution in Iran. So you can see between the two of them, they cover quite a bit of territory. So the format we were going to use tonight is Gidi was going to speak first for 15 or 20 minutes, and then Gary was going to speak, and then open it up to Q&A from the audience. So I'd like to present Gidi as our first speaker.
Thank you, David, for your wonderful introduction, including about me. As David mentioned, I'm a historian, and therefore I will use this occasion to give you some background on how we came to put together this volume. Now, the call to Gary to do the columns for Business Week came in 1985. When he got the call from one of the editors of Business Week, his initial reaction was, no way, I'm not going to do this column. The editor told him, why don't you think about it? And Gary decided, he would accept that. And then our friend George Stigler, who was also like Gary, an economist, tried to discourage him. However, to me, this was a great opportunity to be able to bring out the lessons of the market to a much wider audience. Now, you might want to know, why was I so interested in this, trying to disseminate these ideas? For that reason, I have to give you some idea of my own background. I'm from the Middle East originally. I'm an American now, but I come from a Middle Eastern background, and I spent my adolescent years in Iran. Iran at that time was a country struggling with many political, social, and economic issues, inequality, great inequality in wealth, many other social problems. And I grew up feeling very frustrated with the inability of society to do much about these social problems. In addition to that, I come from a family that truly believes in the idea of social justice, helping the poor. These were things that in our family go back to the year 680, when our great ancestor, Imam Hussein, preferred to die than accept injustice. So in a way, this came through mother's milk, if you like, in my case. And not surprisingly, like many other students, high school students of my generation, we all turned to socialism because we thought that was the quickest way to solve society's problems. Then I came to the U.S. to study. I came to college. And while here, my tendencies towards socialism were reinforced at Barnard College, the college I went to. And you might say, how did that happen? I took a course in Western civilization, And we were exposed to the ideas of Adam Smith, his invisible hand, and Marx's ideas. Of course, our teacher, very subtly, she helped us, maneuvered us into seeing the horrors of a selfish society that Adam Smith's ideas would create, and how wonderful it would be to have a society that was all justice and equality, where justice and equality prevailed. So, not surprisingly, my ideas became even more reinforced. Then I became a student of the University of Chicago, a history student. It was at that time that I met Gary Becker. Of course, I had heard a little bit about the horrors of the economics department at the University of Chicago. However, during our first encounter with Gary, during my first meeting with Gary, he told me he was not interested in politics. So in a way, when he asked me to dinner, I thought, oh, well, that's okay. Maybe I could even do some good. During the evening, I told him I was a socialist. I thought he would be horrified. He just smiled. And I spent the rest of the evening trying to convince him of the merits of socialism. At the end of the evening, I was elated because I thought, I've converted one of these Chicago fascists. Of course, it was I who became converted. Through my contact with him, I really learned about the real world, or how markets can really help societies, and they can help those sectors of society who need this most. That, and I began to see that the problems in the Middle East, as in the rest of the world, had nothing to do with capitalism. It had to do more with crony capitalism than capitalism. And that if they allowed markets to operate and allow people to pursue their own self-interest, societies can really prosper. And what was wrong with the Middle East and Iran, like those other countries, was the type of governments they had in power. And it was the governments who were keeping people from blooming and developing. Then, after I had learned many lessons, and yet, once I started teaching at the University of Illinois, I discovered that the ignorance about markets, the ignorance about the benefits of a large government were universal. And this was in the 70s and 80s when the Sandinistas were the heroes of many of my colleagues. So was the government in El Salvador. And I used to get involved in many heated debates with my colleagues about what was wrong with a lot of the underdeveloped countries, etc. And yet I really didn't make any headway. Though I am glad to say that I was able, or I have been able, through my teaching and exposure of the students to some of the ideas that I have learned, to teach them that it's central governments or big governments that do harm rather than markets. So I feel very good about that. But nevertheless, it was not until the offer to Gary came that I felt this was a godsend opportunity for someone like Gary to show a much wider audience than his students and his colleagues and other economists that markets work. So the upshot was that I had done some editing. I also had gone to the Columbia School of Journalism. I had done some newspaper work. And then I thought I would promise Gary that whatever I could do to make his life easier in writing these columns, I would do. And occasionally I could suggest columns, etc. Finally, I was able to convince him. And it has been rough going. It hasn't always been easy to produce a column every month. We lead a very busy life. We have many responsibilities. We both teach. We travel a lot. He is in great demand. Therefore, it's a very hectic to have this additional column. Has been rather hectic for him especially. And has it been worth it? The question is, has it been worth it? Has it really have the columns changed any minds? Have they changed any hearts? Who is to say? I have no idea, but I hope so. However, I am glad that Gary accepted to write these columns. My contribution, of course, has been minuscule, and I don't want to to build that up. But I am glad that whatever input I had, that I did make it, and I convinced him to do this. And in a way, it has really the work he has done has been very rewarding for me. First of all, it has given me an opportunity to learn more from Gary, and because as he develops the columns, as I talk to him about it, I'm the layperson who has to really understand his arguments. So in a way, I feel every time he writes a column and I look at it and we discuss it and I offer my input, I learn something new. So for me, it has been really wonderful. However, I do not want to only emphasize the selfish part of what the columns have done for me. However, I do believe that some of the ideas that Gary has repeatedly mentioned and described in these columns have finally surfaced in some policy quarters. For instance, the term human capital. It's a term that Gary developed, and he has made it, he helped develop it. It's become a part of the lexicon. You hear it, even President Clinton, a few years ago, he mentioned it. Today, everybody mentions it. Another idea is the idea of school vouchers, which Gary's teacher, Milton Friedman, and our very dear and friend Milton Friedman has first suggested. Gary wrote about this several times, and in a way, today, it's no longer shocking to people. It's entering the debate. Was it only these columns, or was it that have made it more popular? I'm not so vain to say yes, but nevertheless, I think it's been an important contribution. The idea that crime also responds to incentive, I think is an idea that Gary has repeatedly written about. And I think it has become recognized that there is an element of incentive in crime, for instance. I think these are important issues, and there are many others that he will be speaking about. And of course, he's the economist, so I will let him develop these ideas. So on the whole, it has been a wonderful experience for both of us, I think, but also I hope it has been a useful contribution to some of the ideas we firmly believe in. So in the long run, or in the my ultimate judgment on the volume that you have before you is that it has been difficult going sometimes. However, it has been a worthwhile undertaking. And thank you very much. And now Gary will talk to you about it.
Thank you, Katie. There's no doubt that the column that we wrote would never have been written, as he said, if she did not, at the time when I was certainly going to turn down this request that came out of the blue, because I had never written a single word for a popular audience before the Business Week request came. But Dee did not keep insisting that I should do it. She could always stop doing it if it doesn't work out. She would help me, and not only be a sounding board, but make many suggestions, topics. So she's done all that. And so while the columns have come out under my name alone, it is not generosity on my part at all, but simply an acknowledgement of the great debt I owe to her that the book is published under her name together, because she has been clearly a major joint author in this endeavor. So let me express my thanks again for that. As Dee said, we're happy we did the columns. It's been tough going at times, and not all of them work out. What I would like to do here is speak a little bit about the couple of the broad principles the one has tried to convey in these columns, and then give a variety of applications and then have discussion. Three, I think, issues or principles that guide the development of the columns. One is that there's a certain thing that we call the economic way of looking at behavior. And that is very broad and covers, as you'll see, for those who have copies and from the examples I'll give, covers an enormous variety of topics. It's not simply confined to, say, understanding demand for apples or oranges or certain tax policy, although that's an important part of it. But it goes well beyond that to cover many subjects that we call sociological, historical, psychological, political. So it's a broad way of looking at behavior. It's a way of analysis. It's an engine of analysis rather than a particular emphasis on, say, material possessions or material part of life. So this is not called the economics of material life. It's called the economics of life. A little bit presumptuous, but it tries to convey the idea that it's a very broad attack, or attempt to be at least a broad attack on many different issues. Now, this engine of analysis has very simple principles. I had a great teacher by the name of Frank Knight, who was also the teacher of Milton Friedman. So, and I also had Milton Friedman as my teacher. So you might say it's a very incestuous relationship at the University of Chicago. But I had Frank Knight toward the end of his career. And I remember him always emphasizing, economics is so simple, he's amazed that so few people understand economics. And it is very simple. And the principles, I think the basic principles are twofold. There are many sub-principles, and it gets very complicated in the application. But the basic principles are that people respond very much to incentives. So if you raise a reward for some activity, you're more likely to find people doing it. And if you raise the cost of punishment, you'll find fewer people doing it. People have, in that sense, this type of rationality, that their choices are not at random. They are systematic. Very simple idea. Some people have always, as you'll see in various contexts, objected to it, denied it. But it's what guides this approach to analysis. And the second idea is that we have scarce resources in society, so there has to be some way of allocating these resources, some kind of equilibrium that emerges. And the great tool that economists have developed is the role of competition as a device for affecting what gets produced, how it gets produced, the cost of what gets produced, and ultimately what the incomes of different people are. We don't always have, a perfect competition, as economists say. It might be imperfect competition or monopoly, but it's the differences between different types of market structures on the competitive and less competitive conditions that will determine, given that people respond to incentives, what actually gets done. These are the fundamental principles. And that's it. If you understand these principles and have a good feel for these principles, you can be a very good economist, whatever your training is. And there are very good people I call excellent economists who have had little training, as Giddy is an example of that. He's trained by Starr and probably maybe has never taken an economics course. But if I had to give her an economic problem and I had to give some economists who are very well trained and very technical, I'd say I'd give the problem to Giddy. He's more likely to come out with the right answer than they are. And there are other examples of that. Some people have a good feel for this. So these are the principles. And the idea of the book is to apply them in a short context. In each column, one of the difficulties of writing a column like the Business Week, it's very different in that sense from a newspaper column. In a magazine column like Business Week, you have a set number of Business Week lines. You have to write 135 Business Week lines. Roughly translates into about 790 words. So you have to get everything in that context. So George Stigler, great economist, that's my best friend, said once that it takes an academic 5 pages just to clear their throat.
try to do that writing at college.
You go out of business very quickly.
If you don't catch people in the first paragraph, you're finished.
You have busy people.
They have a lot of other things to read, and you have to have a first paragraph. That's considered the crucial part in a business column, the first paragraph. And then you only have a few hundred other words to write it in. So you have to make it brief. You can't go dot all the I's and cross all the T's. You have to try to get the main points across. And that's what we try to do there. And let me try to take a few examples out of, there may be 80 or so examples, 100 examples there, a few of them that convey the breadth of the approach, the potential of the economic way of thinking to illuminate problems that are, I think, often confused and poorly understood. Didi mentioned crimes. Let me take crime as one example. I was always puzzled. I wrote a paper on crime called Crime, copying Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment. Then I added colon an economic analysis or an economic approach in the late 60s, in which the argument was that criminals respond to incentives too. Criminals aren't there because of genetics. There was a theory in the 19th century about the genetic determinant of crime. And there may be some genetic component, but it's not mainly genetics that determines whether people become criminals or not. They weren't making choices at random. They were making very systematic choices. I always tell people that, well, people don't know what the odds are of getting caught. I would say most of these criminals know a lot better about these odds than you and I do. That's their bread and butter. That's the people they hang around with. And just like we may know something about what the pay is to professors or to engineers, they know a lot about crime. And they'll respond. And that if you make crime more costly by raising the punishment, either through catching more criminals or punishing more severely, you'll get less crime. Or if you raise the opportunities, the legal opportunities, by improving the quality of schooling, making better jobs available, you will get less crime. So it's not simply a hard line approach to it. It has a hard line because in the short run, that's the most effective way of affecting crime, but it's a much broader way of looking at it. And the argument made then was that, well, we can deter crime. And yet we saw the crime rate explode in the 60s and 70s. And there were lots of explanations that were given for it. Some of them have some truth to them. But one of the things that was pretty obvious was that we were catching fewer criminals and punishing them less severely. There were many intellectuals who were saying that the crime is punishment. Not that crime is the crime, but the crime is punishment. A famous psychiatrist wrote a book called The Crime of Punishment.
Yeah,
exactly. And so there are a few columns in there that were written saying, what's going on here? This crime problem is not one of these things that is God-given. We can control crime. Yes, we want to improve the quality of education, and I'll come to that. Yes, we want to make jobs available. We want to give people good legal alternatives. But in the short run, we can control crime, the vicious crimes that affect living throughout the country, especially urban living and schools and the like, rejecting the ideas that were being perpetrated on us throughout the world by many intellectuals, so we cannot affect it. We should raise the probability of convicting people, and for serious crimes, give more severe punishments. Well, the message was in several columns. I think largely independent of these columns, let me say, but starting in the early 1980s, we did start doing that in the United States. The cost was a sizable increase in number of prisoners, which is regrettable that we have to do that. But the benefits were enormous. There's been an enormous decline in crime in the United States since 1980. It's underestimated because we don't look at the right statistics. The best statistics on that are victimization household surveys, not the police reports. When you look at the victimization surveys, you find property crime went down maybe 30 or 40%, and violent crime went down substantially. There are a number of causes of it, but we now have good studies showing that an important component of it was the fact that we got tougher on crime. We went back a little bit to where we were in the 1950s. So this is one lesson, very simple one, and you have an enormous effect. Now, David mentioned our interesting meeting at the Vatican. It was a very interesting meeting, and the highlight really of some of the experiences that he and I have had in the last few years. The Vatican is moving more away from what has been a traditional sort of government socialist approach to a recognition that markets are more effective in combating poverty and misery than governments. It's not a full recognition in Vatican. There's a fight going on there. I became elected to the Pontifical Academy of Science a few years ago, so I'm a little bit involved in this. But I wrote a column, maybe one of the first columns in that book, using the idea of competition in trying to understand religion, in that following sense, understand religion, let me say, in a modest sense in the way it came out, that religion is an industry too, so to speak, an important industry. Religion is an important part of the life of many people. But do we do better in a religious environment where there's one religion that has a government or other monopoly? Or do we do better in an environment where religions are allowed to compete for spiritual, so to speak, guidance? And the argument there was that the advantages of competition apply as well to religion as it does elsewhere, and that the endeavors of each organization to get monopoly applies as much to religion as anywhere else as well. So in many countries where a particular religion gets powerful, they often try to stamp out other religions. They get protected positions either through government subsidies or through making other religions not legal. And the essay argues that religion, however, is most vibrant in environments where religions compete with each other. The United States is the best example of that. By almost every measure of religiosity, belief in God, attendance in church, and so on, the United States, along with, ranks very close to the top. And we probably have the most competitive, if you will, religious environment of any country in the world. On the other hand, countries like Scandinavia, where there's been a state-protected, religions are allowed, of course, in Scandinavia, but there's been a state-protected religion in the sense that there's been the one religion that has a subsidy each year. Almost nobody attends church. And I think there's no accident that in the competitive environment you have a really well-developed, very competitive religious environment, and in the monopoly environment, you have a very weak religion. So that essay tries to apply competition to an area that many of you might not have thought is so applicable. Another topic that I had, a general area that I've had fun with in the columns, is the role of women in the economy. Very important area. Professional woman that works full time, and increasingly, of course, women have entered into the labor force and made more and more contributions to the labor force. On the other hand, it's also true that women have continued and have traditionally played a major role in bringing up children, and so to speak, providing the human capital for the next generation. The most important form of capital in the economy, as I'll come to in a moment, is human capital. And that takes place in schools, of course, takes place at meetings like this, that the Independent Institute, an important force in, so to speak, producing and spreading human capital. But it takes place in an enormously crucial and essential way in the home. Okay. What's the value of women's contribution in the home? But where do we find it in national income accounts? Well, of course, the answer is we don't find it. This national income account was developed as measuring activities that go through market transactions. Of course, they're important. But what about those major forms of activities that do not go through market transactions? What about all the advice that Dini has given me all the time? Where's the value for that in our national income account? I value it. To me, it's priceless. But where's its value? The value in rearing children and teaching them not only information about the alphabet and knowledge, but values, ethics, that women have played such a major role in. Where is that contribution? Now, you might say, well, you can't measure that. Well, you can't measure it perfectly accurately, but we measure a lot of things that we can't measure. The national income account has a major component called the service sector. Most of it very difficult to measure. But with practice and attempts, you do better than when you start. And we can get rough estimates of the contribution of women in the household to national income. And I give some examples of that in that column. Now, why is that important? Well, first of all, it's important for getting a better assessment of the total income of an economy. Secondly, it's important in getting a better assessment of the fact that women who stay at home are making a contribution, often more than their husbands are making, whose contribution shows up in national income accounts. I think it will play a role if it had a value attached to it in giving women who stay at home a greater feeling of self-respect and contribution that many of them feel instinctively, but since there's no value attached to it, their husband may be making, let's say, $20,000 a year. They're really contributing, let's say, $30,000 a year, but it's not showing up in anything. So there's several columns in the book on role of women, which has been an important interest of ours, but one in particular on why we should modify the national income accounts. Probably the most serious limitation in these accounts is the omission of the contribution that women make in that household. Now, let me take one final example and then we'll have questions. Dini mentioned the importance of human capital, and that's, of course, been a long-term interest of mine. I wrote a book in the early 60s called Human Capital. I didn't invent the name by any means, but maybe the book helped spread it a little bit. And it's easy to see from simple calculations that if we ask what's the major source of wealth in a country like the United States, it's not property, it's not machinery, it's not equipment. It's the knowledge and skills that people have. It's us, so to speak. It's what we have, rather than the value of the machines. People have made direct calculations of that, but I won't go into that. If you just look at, say, the contribution of wages and salaries to national income, it's about 75% to 80% in the United States. Most of that is due to the skills, the training that people have. If we all had to rely on simply our physical brute strength, speaking for myself, I'd be below the minimum wage, that I know. So most of the wage and salary component is the human capital that people have. And that shows up in the importance of having a good public school system, why I've been a strong supporter of vouchers. I think the only way we're going to ever reform the K-12 school system, particularly for people in the inner city, is through a choice and competition. Competition working there as when anywhere else. We won't be able to do it simply by testing and other criteria that are being advanced. We need the competition that will improve the public school systems as well as bring in private schools into it. The only place where Milton Friedman and I differ on that, and as Dee said, Milton Friedman is the pioneer in the idea of vouchers, that I tend to believe that we really, really want to aim is for vouchers for the poor to find flexibly, and that ultimately move in the direction where the middle classes and others sort of pay directly for their schooling, public or private. I mean, we all pay indirectly because some of the resources have to come from someplace. He believes that vouchers should be for everybody. So that's a difference, not a negligible difference, but the notion that you need competition is certainly crucial, and there's no disagreement on that. And you won't be able to improve significantly the public schools, particularly for those who need it, who are getting the worst deal now, those at the lower end, without some form of competition. And vouchers is the best way to do that. Well, in 1987, I had a column due on a Thursday, and Monday I was putting the finishing touches on a column on unionism and why unions were monopolies. And all of a sudden, my editor called me from Business Week and said, "Did you hear what happened to the stock market?" I said, "No, what?" He said, "It was down by 22% today." I said, "Shouldn't you write a column on the stock market crash?" I said, "Well, there's not much time left. That's a pretty good idea." I said, "I didn't want to be the story I heard." There was a very famous economist by the name of Wesley Mitchell, expert on business cycles. He was the world's greatest expert on business cycle in his day. And he was teaching a class in 1929. And on business cycles, and he came into class one day, and it was the stock market had crashed, and he continued to read from his notes, never mentioned the crash. So I said, "Yes, if I have this opportunity, let me write about this crash. It's not 1929. Business Week was then coming out with a cover story saying, "Another Great Depression?" Well, my column said, and it's in there, there's not going to be a depression. And why? I said, yes, 22% decline in the stock market's a lot. I had an estimate of what it meant for total, how many trillions were lost. I said, but look, human capital is the bulk of all our wealth. No evidence that the valuation placed on human capital has been much affected by this. So this big effect, this 22% decline in stock values, is probably only, and I gave some figures, I don't remember now, a few percentage decline in total wealth. That's all. It's going to affect the demand for some luxury goods, because the people who owned stock, particularly in 87, were mainly wealthier people. So the demand for expensive cars are going to go down. Art market's going to be affected some. Trophy homes market is going to go down. So the basic economy isn't going to be much affected by it. I think it came out in the same issue as Business Week's cover story that we'll be making for 1929. Well, we didn't have a crash. In fact, a market and economy crash. If you look at economic statistics, you can't even detect the effect of that stock market crash. Now, let me caution by saying we economists are very poor at short-term predictions. And this is one of the few ones that I got right. So I'm not claiming I can tell you what's going to happen. But what I'm illustrating that is not the quality of the prediction, but the fact that recognizing the importance of human capital, I think, led me in the right direction and led Business Week and many other people at that time in the wrong direction. Well, I'll just conclude by saying, hope you read the book. There are many other examples there. The examples, in a sense, try to make economics fun to some extent, as Dede said. I try to make it fun in discussing a lot of topics, not always successfully. Should we have marriage contracts? What would be the consequences of that? How should we reform divorce laws? Should we go after fathers who don't support their children, who have child support payments that are due? What about the greenhouse effect? Should we take it seriously? And if so, what if anything should we do about it? Is population a big threat for the world or not? Cuba and Taiwan were similar in 1959. Both small islands, pretty well off. Why are they so different now? And so on. So we had a lot of fun. I hope those of you who read the book have it too, and in particular, I hope you see that there is a way of looking at a lot of behavior that is simple, doesn't need a lot of jargon, and that it can throw a light on a lot of problems that are often misunderstood, and public policy
goes in the wrong direction. Thank you.